Okay, so we're ready to start. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the New York City Marxist School Rec Forum. I want to thank everybody for making it here tonight. Good attendance in the house. I also want to, on behalf of the panelists and the signers of the open letter, express our gratitude to the Breck Forum for hosting this event. We see this as an important opportunity to engage in some serious struggle around the issue of racism and white supremacy and building a multiracial, anti-racist movement against the war at home and abroad. So again, thank you all for being here. My name is Randy Jackson. I'm the development director of the Miami Workers Center, which is a grassroots organizing and strategy center based in Miami, and we do work organizing no and low wage workers in low income communities throughout the county, and we have collaborative relationships with other no and low wage worker organizations throughout the country. I've also been involved locally as an activist in the peace and justice movement since 9/11. So before I introduce the panelists, I just wanted to sort of frame what we were hoping for this panel and this event to be, and what we hope to get out of this discussion after we have the presentation from the panelists. So first of all, a caveat. One, it's not our intention for this to be a guilt trip for white folks. That was never the intention of this meeting, and it's not the intention of the letter either. But what we do want to do is we feel like what we're raising in the letter and what we want to raise here today are issues that centrally address the importance of race, racism, and white supremacy, and how that is an obstacle and an impediment for us to building the broadest anti-imperialist movement against the war, but also how that impacts our work in building a movement for social, economic, and political justice and equality for the long haul. So some of the panelists who are here tonight are some of the co-signers of the letter that was released in February. Some of them are not. They all come from different organizations and organizing experiences on the ground. But the point of departure that the panelists bring to this session and to the reason why we want to address and feel it's important to put this issue at the forefront is because we don't think that a multiracial movement for social and economic justice can have an anti-racist perspective be at the periphery of both our practice and our analysis, that needs to be central to both our analysis and our practice. And so the folks who are going to be speaking tonight are going to address both of those issues from a theoretical and a practical perspective. So just real quickly, our panelists who are here tonight are, first off, and who's going to kick it off is Humberto Brown, who's a member of the Black Radical Congress, and also a member of the Breck Forum, and a member of the African Descendants Caucus, and a participant and representative to the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. So, Humberto, pass it over to you.
Good evening.
Good afternoon.
I just basically what I'm going to attempt to do. I don't want to get into intellectual discussion of this matter because I think a lot of time when we discuss the issue of racism and different sectors participate, we discuss concept, we discuss terminologies, and we can get lost in those things because at the end, most of the theories and most of the conception gets defined in practice. where things happen, how it happens, and when it happens. I also think it's important to clarify that in attempting to address an issue as racial discrimination, racism, white supremacy, it's such a complex issue. It is structured in so many aspects of a society that we're not even going to attempt to differentiate what's happened between state relationship of state and civil society, and sometime if we even discuss it, racism in conservative and reactionary movements that come clearly and easier to define. I think what is most challenging about this discussion or the letter is that the letter tried to address people who have defined themselves progressive, who have defined themselves involved in social changes, who define themselves some anti-capitalist, some anti-repression, anti-sexism. We could go the range of definition that people have. So this discussion put us at a place to ask ourselves some questions about, can people, once you define yourself as anti-system or progressive, are you affected by the same ideology, culture that you're criticizing? Are you impacted in any way by those values that you are now denouncing and separating yourself from? And I think that's what makes it difficult to discuss the issue of racism in the progressive sector. But this is not new. It's not a new issue. If you look at it historically, every historical period of struggle, it means that different sectors have engaged in that struggle from different locations, from different places in the society. And for people who are here in the Americas, who come from a legacy of slavery, more than 250 years of slavery, then segregation, and system that maintain people structurally oppressed, and with tools of both state, institutional, and civil society tools of repression, as lynching, to block their ability and capability of intervening in their own behalf, we have to have an historical context to understand that legacy. There's a special, for me, a special historical moment in this period of imperialism, global capitalism, that brings some important aspect of why it's so complex when we encounter this problem. And after 9/11, we no longer had a movement, even if we were to look at historically in the U.S., where the issue of racism was fought both in the early part of the, when W. Du Bois wrote his book and the Soul of Black Folks, or the struggle between the 50s and the 60s with different perspective from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King. We're talking about a movement now post 1960 with assumedly rules and engagement of affirmative action, with some assumption that we're in a society that people understand what racism is. It was post the UN conference against racism that worldwide discussed racism and xenophobia and dealt with white supremacy, and which as we define in the document, I don't want to repeat, understanding it as an not only an ideological tool, but an institutional form of privilege that become invisible if you understand the complex relationship that encompasses it. But we see the results. We know the results. We don't need to repeat the statistic in health, education, housing, imprisonment, who served the army. We know the numbers. What was, to me, significant of the first gathering or the attempt to respond to the invasion of Afghanistan and then with Iraq, is that you have a new constellation of forces who come from different historical experience of racism, colonialism, legacy of it. You have people from directly from the continent of Africa, result of the wars and result of the legacy of poverty created by these both the slavery and colonialism. You have people from Latin America who are here in the U.S. because of the relationship with the United States and the development in their countries, the war within their countries during the War of Liberation in the 60s. And you have people who, indigenous people, who experience racism here in the Americas and throughout the world. So what happened when people get together and have different construct of who they are, why they're here, and what is threatening to them? What happened during that period is we see that we have now some very complex form of racist policy that affect people differently and people conceptualize themselves differently. First thing that go through the window is the binary system of black and white. There's no longer just black and white. You have a multiple form where these things express itself. You have the presence of people who also have experienced directly from the hands of a U.S. imperialism of invasion and war, so therefore they don't see the United States from only from within as an oppressor racially or ethnically or gender-wise. They also see them as an imperialist force. Those contradictions reflected itself in some of the discussion that took place, because the discussion started constructing an alternative to criticizing U.S. imperialism, attempting to stop the war, and attempting to make sure that you don't support policies that would endanger new immigrants, other sectors who were in the U.S. under different status and vision the U.S. differently. So therefore, when we end up on the point of discussing national security or discussing getting those who committed the crime on 9/11 and some of the tools that were proposed, open the question to a lot of others that were not white mainstream, who were not identified only within the U.S. patriotism, I would say U.S. patriotism on the left, find themselves vulnerable. And where the issue for me became very serious is that attempting to address those issues, we encounter some incredible barriers where this racist attitude and conception of other people emerge silently. Because what is interesting, it never come out simple. It never come out and say, I'm racist. It just come out in behaviors that are traditional. Who speaks, who understand, who's a priority, who interests are we trying to define? And I've lived in this country long enough, and it opens some question about patriotism. Patriotism is on the left. The left was trapped in trying to claim that they had to appropriate a national identity and patriotism in the U.S., not to alienate other Americans, and therefore also appropriated some of the racism that is inherent in that concept of patriotism. Jose Marti, defining patriotism for Latin America against the U.S., said, patria es humanidad. And that's a difference. And I don't think we're able to take the discussion to that level. And I want to conclude, because we all have very limited time. I just want to raise, because it's hard to bring a lot of these things together, is that the history of racism in social and progressive movement is not new. That movement affected the labor movement in this country, where in the most progressive period, black people could not participate, were not members. Racism affected electoral politics, where black people couldn't vote. Racism affected black people after every one of the major war, where they didn't get treated the same. Racism affected black people in this country in relation to suffrage, the right to vote. It has always matters. Racism and class definitions country has always intertwined with each other, another complex form of oppression. is important for the progressive movement is it's going to define itself as a tool of change, as a tool of creating new social movement. It has to move away from some of the essentialist concept of class that in a way negate the complexity of how class relate with different sectors, with different ethnic sector, different race sector, and how the class, because the class also have a racial and ethnic identity within it. And we think that this it is important to start understanding that complexity if we want to build a new movement. Thank you. I hope I can answer more in question and answer.
So before I introduce our next panelist, I just wanted to point out that we also have one panelist who is expected to arrive before the conclusion of this panel. That's Asif Ullah, who's a representative of the War Resisters League. So he will have a few words before we wrap up as well. So from a general perspective and addressing some of the root causes and some of the root analysis around racism and white supremacy, our next presenter, Merle Ratner, is going to discuss some of the specific examples of white supremacy and racism that were experienced by different folks within the movement post 9/11. And she'll also address some of the responses to the letter since it was published in February, and also address some of the constructive criticism that we've received, that some of us have received as signers of the letter since that time. So our next panelist is Merle Ratner, and she's a member of the Brecht Forum and also a Vietnam solidarity activist.
Okay, I'm going to try to... Is that okay? Thank you. I'm really happy to be here, and I want to actually start where Roberto left off, which is that the struggle against racism and white supremacy in the progressive and left movement is not a new struggle. It has a whole historical basis that Roberto talked about. But it reemerges in a new way after September 11th. The new way really has to do with the reemergence of a movement after September 11th. That there is a flow in the movement. There's not entirely new people. It's continuity of existing movements that go back to the 30s and 60s and even more historically. But there's a new flow around the necessity to immediately respond to the U.S. government's war at home and abroad against people. And a lot of new people become reactivated or activated. A lot of new people come into the movement. And this means that there's a lot of people in action, which is great, but it also re-raises the same old dynamics that are existing in the movement and in society around racism and white supremacy. And this came up immediately in the first meeting that we had around September 11th, several days later. A process was put into motion to form a coalition to respond to the situation post 9/11, to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and the detentions of immigrants and other people here in the U.S. And immediately those dynamics began to reassert themselves. And I'll talk a little bit more about the categories of who, but basically the same kind of thing that Alberta was referring to. You know, who really counts? Who has power? Who gets to speak, either in meetings or representing the anti-war movement? Who really is the anti-war movement? When you talk about the average people or the masses or whatever you want to call it, who are you really talking about? Is there a default where you're talking about white folks, or you're really talking about who's out there, who's acting, who's really being affected by this? And I'll talk about that a little bit later, but what I wanted to say that the reason that this takes on heightened urgency in this period is because those most affected by the situation around the world and in the U.S. have been, you know, people in communities of color, working people, immigrants. And thus, those correspondingly, those communities in the U.S. have also been those who polls have shown are the most opposed to the U.S. war drive, both at home and abroad. So you have figures up to 80% of the African-American community being opposed to the war very early. And that's true about many, many other communities of color. And the changing integration by the U.S. government of the war at home and abroad and of the integration of the racial profiling and the historic racism into this war drive means that we really need to educate, organize, and mobilize everybody and really have a very active, very dynamic opposition that's united. And those that are the most affected, those that are the most conscious have been, really have to be targeted. And if you look at the demographics of New York City, who are the majority communities in New York City? More than, it's almost two-thirds of the population of New York City are people of color. And that's a change from the 60s when, That's a change from the 60s when many of the older activists were active. So aside from the question of sharing of power and of justice and all that, in very practical sense, if you're talking about mobilizing communities of color, mobilizing communities of New York, they're overwhelmingly communities of color. If you look at the working class communities, the immigrant communities, and the figure is even much higher. And that also has to do with a new generation of activists that have to be engaged, who also are not... I better speed up. There's a lot of changes which sort of really heighten the need to look at racism and white supremacy in the movement. And to say that we can't have a segregated movement or a movement where white folks really control the power and the resources is really what it comes down to. So basically what we found in the post-9/11 peace and justice movement was that racism and white supremacy were hindering the ability to build a movement that was really effective and really capable of contending for change in this country and internationally. And this came into a number of ways that this happened. One was creating an unwelcome or dangerous climate for activists of color, people of color, to be in the movement or actually excluding them from the movement. This had everything to do with, for example, insisting on doing direct action in an activity called by the community in Harlem against the war, where white activists came and said, you know, we want to do a building there, we want to do CD. And people said, well, yeah, but you don't live in this community, you're not going to be the ones targeted, you're going to do it and leave. And there was a whole struggle around to say, no, direct action is important and good. And it's a good tactic, but you've got to take lead from people in the community you're working with and really look at what's going to be effective and what's going to allow them to have a safe space to develop the movement in their own community. And there are other examples. Other things, just refusing to accept leadership from organizations of color, people of color. So, for example, saying, well, you know, white activists, maybe older white activists saying, we've always been in the leadership. We've done it this way since the 60s. We are the movement. People of color, you know, may be active, but they're not anti-war activists. And people actually have the gall to say, for example, that Muhammad Ali, who was one of the big figures, said no to the Vietnam War, who said, I won't go fight. No Vietnamese ever called me a nigger. To deny that he was an anti-war activist. Or Angela Davis, or people, you know, in the Black Radical Congress today, or the many resistors who said, people of color who said no to serving the military in the Gulf. So refusing to acknowledge that we should actually dissing the role. Or promoting positions on more, talking about the impact of war on more privileged communities, but not looking at the impact on the most underserved communities. I have a lot of other examples. There's been actually a coalition that was split because a lot of the older white activists didn't want to work with folks from communities of color that had, were working and exercising leadership. I want to talk, though, now a little bit about the impact and responses to our letter. Our letter went out to thousands of people on email, has been widely distributed, picked up by ZNet and a lot of other listservs. The letter was intended to promote dialogue and change in the movement. It was written collectively by the 15 signers. We received over 200 responses on the email address we sent out, which is on the letter that you have. And most were very supportive. There were a lot of people saying, how can we help? You have suggestions on how we can take up the fight against racism and build a multiracial anti-war movement where we are, and asked for, or giving examples of what they did and encouragement. The criticism were of two sorts. One, there was a number of people who thought the letter divided the movement or the working class, and that's a letter that the signers, that's a criticism that the signers don't agree with. What we do agree with is another sort of set of criticisms that Umberto referred to that said that our letter didn't sufficiently root racism and white supremacy and privilege in the U.S. history of settler colonialism, slavery, and racism, that we should have paid more attention to the intersection of race, class, and gender oppression in our major focus on racism and white supremacy. And we're going to respond to that and try to deepen our critique of that. The last thing I want to end up with, and I may take one extra minute if I can, is a special responsibility of white activists. And again, I think this is really important because of the position that we as white activists have in a society that's a capitalist, racist, sexist society. So this issue of privilege is not a question, it's not a moral question, it's a real question of positioning. For example, you know, you go out for an apartment, and you're white and you get the apartment and people call excluded. That's a reality. That gives us certain privilege, and that also extends to the movement. So I think what happens is that white people have to realize that because of that, because of our experiences, if we don't struggle with it, that we can sometimes consciously and sometimes often unconsciously replicate racist dynamics in the movement. We have to be conscious of these dynamics and have to share leadership and resources with people of color. Listen, the first thing is to listen to people of color who listen to criticisms of our own practice. That means we have to be willing to follow the leadership of people of color, organizations of color, very consciously, and to share resources and to not dominate them. To maintain an attitude of collectivity, not dominate discussions, challenge racist language and actions, especially within movement spaces, and prioritize issues and experiences and struggles of people of color. The last two points I want to make is that, and this wasn't as much in our letter, but it's come up, another thing that white activists do is sometimes become very patronizing and condescending and saying, well, it's not me. You know, I did something I did maybe wasn't me. My African-American friend said it's okay. Or I don't see race at all. I mean, it doesn't, you know, I can't be racist. I think we have to look to take responsibility for our actions and what we do and not hide behind expressions of either race neutrality or, you know, my friend in this community said it's okay. The last thing I want to say is encouraging, just that there's real hope. Building real and principled unity takes a lot of time and struggle. And sometimes it's not easy. It can be very painful. But on the end, it's really the only way to build a strong and enduring and successful movement. It's the only way to build real trust and collective practice that makes activism rewarding. It's the only way to win and the only way to really do what we say we want to do, which is really reorient the resources of society. So when we say another world is possible, as the anti-globalization movement means, that means that everyone, the majority communities, especially share the resources and the power and the leadership of society and of our movement. And I think if we do that, then we have a better basis to win. Thank you.
Thanks, Merle. So one of the things that has been sort of central to, one of the issues that has been central to the global movement, and which has also emerged as a central issue and often an issue that's divided the actual anti-war movement, has been positioned around the centrality of the Palestinian liberation movement and the role of Palestine. So our next speaker will speak about both the issue, the centrality of that issue, and some of the experiences related to the Palestinian liberation movement in the anti-war movement, as well as the issue of racism as it impacts the Arab American and Muslim communities. So it's my pleasure to introduce Shireen Saikali, who is a Palestinian-American activist and a member of New York NYU Students for Justice in Palestine.
So I have 8 minutes to run through that whole list, which is a big one. So I'm going to read from some notes I have. For the last year, I, like many Palestinian activists, have been moved by the massive public displays of support for Palestinian self-determination and by how central the question of Palestine has been to the anti-war movement as a whole. At the same time, I am dismayed by both the amount of racism directed against Arabs and Muslims and the extent to which this racism has impeded our efforts to work for peace and justice. In the case of Palestine, the commitment of diverse activists and concerned people is testament to the growing strength of the movement in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for decolonization and freedom in the United States and internationally. As this movement spreads on college campuses, in neighborhoods, and in communities, we have repeatedly faced the same challenge. Time and again, we are asked to disprove our anti-Semitism before we can even begin to be understood as legitimate. This is despite our explicit diversity that stands against the targeting of innocent civilians, Palestinians and Israelis, and the well-developed foundations of anti-racism that we draw on from various social movements. In effect, these accusations attempt to morally delegitimize our work and silence our criticism of Zionism and Israeli policy. At the same time, while we defend ourselves, we are left pondering why individuals and institutions who uncritically support Israeli occupation are never publicly asked to demonstrate their own anti-racism. Mainstream media representations of Palestine solidarity work often replicate the representation of the Palestinian struggle itself as somehow inherently racist, unjustifiable, or existentially threatening to Jews. The fact of the matter is that the logic of colonialism and the logic of Israeli occupation is at base the logic of racism. This dehumanization is not new for Palestinians. The process began when historic Palestine was defined by Zionist ideology as a land without a people for a people without a land. And eventually in 1948, 800,000 Palestinians were dispossessed. The existence of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish bigotry is a real phenomenon that we must continue to confront, condemn, and resist. At the same time, it is as urgent now as ever to face and undo the idea that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. The success of Zionism as an ideology depends on collapsing the categories of Jew and Zionist. It is this conflation that we must undo on various levels. As Palestine solidarity work grows, it is our challenge to continue building and enriching a principled solidarity movement, one based on the foundations of equality and freedom, and that envisions an alternative order. As we do so, we will remain committed to the Palestinian struggle with the understanding that the stripping of basic human rights by colonial occupation and military force is morally unjustifiable. The conflict in Israel-Palestine is part of a broader historical struggle that is not about ethnicity or identity, but about colonialism. It was not anti-white to deplore the dispossession of Native Americans. It was not anti-white to work to end apartheid, and it is not anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish to call for ending the occupation and ending it now. Beyond the specific situations faced by the Palestine Solidarity Movement, Arabs and Muslims in general are confronted with the daily struggles of being the public enemy in this country. Detentions, arrests, and deportations have become common in these communities. At the same time, overt expressions of Arabs and Muslims as backward, irrational, violent, and anti-democratic are everywhere to be seen and heard in the United States. Yet again, Arabs and Muslims are often understood as not simply different from Western American social norms, but also a direct threat to these norms. While most progressives are critical of Bush and his pundits, claims to liberate and democratize Iraq and the Middle East, there remains a residual tendency to categorize Arabs and Muslims in racist terms, even in progressive circles. One of the ways this racism expresses itself most clearly is in the category of gender. While most feminists laughed at the immediate sort of Laura Bush, you know, being committed to Afghani women's liberation, at the same time, I've personally come across many serious committed activists who defend American policy on the grounds that however bad sanctions, war, or occupation are, U.S. intervention has the potential to improve the status of women in the Arab and Muslim world. Few of these people know anything of the history of women's movements and organizations in the Middle East or beyond, or of how U.S. policy has strengthened patriarchal regimes in almost every instance. Our responsibility in this country in terms of women's liberation in the Middle East or anywhere for that matter is to forge principled alliances with feminists and activists in places like Palestine and Iraq, and moreover, to challenge the homegrown forces of colonialism and empire that continue to subjugate women globally. Hostility towards the Palestinian solidarity movement in particular and Arabs in general hampers our ability to build the broadest resistance possible to the United States policy. As activists, we must recognize the depth of Israeli and American military and economic alliance since Israel's inception. Today, these links are more clear than ever. The connections between the occupations of Iraq and Palestine should be obvious. From the Apache helicopters and M1 tanks to the geography of the searches, street cultures, and checkpoints, it is painfully clear that the tactics developed in Palestine are being expanded in Iraq. It is equally important to recognize that a neo-colonial Iraq and a neoliberal Israel-Palestine are central to American economic hegemony, one example of which is the plans for our very own NAFTA, Middle East Free Trade Association. Moreover, the expansion and consolidation of American hegemony in the Middle East and the continued occupation of Palestine will only serve to strengthen the repressive regimes in Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Not only are all three governments dependent on U.S. military and economic aid, but each relies on hypocritical condemnations of American policy in order to silence opposition and dissent in their own countries. Ultimately, the occupations of Iraq and Palestine, thousands of miles from us, but only hundreds of miles from each other, today form two of the most visible experiences of inequality and oppression in the world. Any effort to halt the expansion of American political and economic empire has to recognize this connection, along with the fact that no country or government can ever be secure as long as it colonizes, subjugates, or occupies another people. The groundwork for a Middle East anti-war movement requires focusing on the suspension of U.S. military aid to Israel as one expression of a rejection of U.S. interventionism in the Middle East. On February 15, hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers marched against the war on Iraq. We joined the millions in the streets of the world. Solidarity with the Palestinian liberation struggle was an unmistakable part of the message echoed throughout the world. As we struggle to reorganize our opposition to U.S. policy, I would urge those of us in this room to remember the connection between racism at home, empire abroad, and the importance of Palestinian freedom in our common struggle for a peaceful and just world.
As some of our panelists have already pointed out, one of our points of departure has been the centrality both of the experiences but also the leadership of communities of color as well as women of color in an anti-war movement and in the broader movement for social and economic justice globally. One of the other things that we take as a point of departure is building the broadest movement of opposition that's possible. So we see within the centrality of people of within the central role of people of color that there's also multiple sectors that we're trying to join together as a movement. And one of those sectors is the pacifist movement that does have a history in opposition to militarization. And our next speaker is Asifullah, who is the Roots Program Coordinator of the War Resisters League. And the Roots Program, maybe you could describe it a little bit more in your introductions, is the youth program of the War Resisters League.
It's a good thing I got some food, because if I assumed there is going to be food here, I'd be a real hungry person. We got to find a way to feed the people here from now on. You know, I'm just getting back from Philadelphia. Literally, I just got off the bus and came over here. We just did a national counter recruitment conference in Philadelphia with a bunch of other counter recruitment organizations throughout the country, and some of these same issues did come up as well, and it almost kind of, as some people put it, hijacked the conference. And it happened towards the end. So my name is Asif, and I coordinate a program called Roots, which is a counter-military recruitment program, and co-produce and co-edit a magazine and CD called AWOL, which is a hip-hop magazine and CD. Thank you. And part of that is organizing concerts and just really challenging people through embracing our own culture of the streets and, you know, putting it out there. So Roots has its foundation in the War Resisters League. And the War Resisters League is an 80-year-old pacifist organization which came into existence shortly after World War I and began by a few people coming together and saying that there was a shift in U.S. foreign policy and a new role in U.S. militarism, deciding to take a conscientious objector anti-war stance. And that's kind of been the thread and theme of the organization throughout its history. Unfortunately, though, there's never really been much of a race analysis within that and looking critically at who's being impacted and how to go about working actively to challenge that both internally as well as in the program work. What that raises also is the issue of the people who are often looked upon as the figures of the pacifist movement. And this is also, you know, this is not necessarily restricted to War Resisters League. This is kind of across the board. You know, the figures of a pacifist movement primarily are Gandhi and King. And they're constantly touted and used against us, meaning, you know, people of color who might have a different perspective on nonviolence. Nonviolence that embraces our communities, which are inherently in a violent existence. So, someone having to, you know, run to the store and do what they need to do to feed their family is not necessary. Some of us don't see that as being violent. And oftentimes the distinction is made about personal nonviolence versus political nonviolence. And so oftentimes when some of these pacifists are asked about what would they do in the situation if one of their, you know, daughters were to be raped or one of their sisters and they were about to be brutalized and they could prevent that, they say, well, that's not comparable to, you know, political nonviolence. Well, a lot of people, like Palestinians, like people in Zimbabwe, like people in India, like people in Puerto Rico, like people in Colombia, and throughout the world live through in an organized, systemic, you know, personal nonviolence. And so that analysis, again, of nonviolence has been systematically used against us as people of color who've been in the organization, as well as has been used as a rallying point to undermine other efforts and exacerbate and factionalism and tensions within the movement. I've worked at the organization for a little over 4 years now, and the program I inherited was called Youth Peace. Youth Peace, for my, you know, surveys, meant nothing more than it conjured the image of doves, of, you know, of a treehouse club and so on for a lot of young people who aren't necessarily feeling that name. And that, you know, that aesthetic question is something that's really integral in terms of doing our work. You know, part of the issue that we're focusing on here is race, but one of the issues that I'm, you know, I'm constantly experiencing and seeing a lot of other young people experience within both, you know, the so-called anti-racist movement, anti-war movement, as well as at large, is just intense adultism. I mean, even in terms of the ways in which, you know, some of us are deemed as being the historic figures and kind of giving an analysis of that versus some of us who might present an experiential knowledge, you know, that itself, you know, kind of falls within categories. And, you know, also just in terms of language that we, personally experiencing activism coming out of New York City, going from kindergarten through college here in the city, and, you know, being attacked with language that did not mean anything to me, and in fact alienated me, is something that's very typical of, you know, organizations like WRL, but also, you know, it's also pretty present within our own movements where academic language is somehow or another, you know, again, like, creates this classism. And I think that's something that's really important and key to look at as well, and that's one of the things we're trying to do with Roots and AWOL Hip Hop Magazine. The War Resisters League has had some pretty violent reactions to a proposal myself and some other people wrote that accused the organization of 80 years of racism, meaning since its existence, and that didn't go down well. I was in a room in North Carolina with 40 other people, and besides myself, I think there was one Asian male, and I think he was he's half Asian, half white, and oftentimes that can play a factor as well in terms of people's politics. Again, and even the term people of color, I personally prefer colonized peoples, because we're coming from different backgrounds. There's intense issues within our own communities that we need to work out, and that's important that we do get together and have these spaces. The War Resisters League does not even offer that type of space for us to just be able to have a body of people convene and look at how nonviolent and the way it's being utilized is violent for a lot of us. And I think we need to call it for what it is. You have figures there that have been there for 40, 50 years, and they kind of exist as deities within this pacifist movement. And so when they speak, their word is law. And one of the things that's happening right now as a result of the proposal I wrote, and shortly after that proposal, which asked for very specific structural changes, including as one of the demands, having anti-oppression trainings be a requisite for anyone who's in any decision-making body of the organization. And again, we're very clear that this is not just an issue of racism. These are integral issues. We can't amputate race from class, from sexism, and so on. That, again, people have to go through these trainings. 6 months later, the organization has semi-annual meetings. 6 months later, there were about 12 proposals, 10 of which were to attempt to scrape the program and get rid of me from the organization. And when that wasn't successful, if anybody reads the Nonviolent Activist, which is the publication of the War Resisters League, I personally don't, but there might be people out there that do. There's an article by David McReynolds where he speaks about his being victimized, and woe is him, he's kind of relegated to feeding the cat in the office now. And he's been around in the movement for so long, and this is what he has to do. I walk into the office and find stacks of letters of how different funders are pulling out. And the daily violence that I experience there is pretty intense. But one of the things that I think is really important to note is that has serious repercussions in terms of not just the psychological toll it takes in terms of being personally on a defense and trial, but also in terms of what white flight means for organizations like WRL, where that does potentially mean jeopardizing the base and the very livelihood of the organization. When key figures like the ones I mentioned leave, that does, that could mean the end of the organization. So, I mean, that's one thing to consider. That's something I'm experiencing right now. I'm not sure how much longer I could be there. I've been there for over 4 years. I've done what I can. Hopefully I can shop the Roots program around. We're doing some serious counter-recruitment work right now, getting into the high schools throughout the country, working on many conferences. And, if we're going to hopefully talk about ways in which we can actively get involved, both as white anti-racist folks as well as middle-class people of color, people, adults and so on, there's real tangible ways in which we could support movements, youth movements on the ground, from kids on the streets. So, I'm definitely down to talk a little bit more about that. I know my time is up, but thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And one of the things that Asif raises is actually something that we're interested in getting into in the discussion, is how is it that, we can raise the issue of racism and white supremacy and deal with it within our own organizations and as well as on a personal level. So taking it from the actual experiences of two sectors of the movement, the pacifist movement and the Palestinian movement, our next speaker, Hani Khalil, will speak and address some of the experiences building up to and post February 15th, and the particular experiences that have played out in United for Peace and Justice, and some of the lessons that we can gather from those experiences so far. So Hani Khalil is the New York City coordinator for distribution of the of War Times, a national periodical, which is actually available here. And he's also been involved with Racial Justice 9/11, and he's currently working as staff coordinator for United for Peace and Justice. Hani Khalil.
I'll just begin by passing this around if you could. Copy of War Times, and there's a copy of one useful document, the Unity Statement for United for Peace and Justice that we just agreed to in Chicago about a month ago. Yeah. So, thanks everybody. It's good to see everybody here tonight. Folks that I don't know, a lot of folks from United for Peace and Justice to have a conversation about where we are and how to move forward. Lots of other folks as well, so that's great. The letter that we developed, I was one of the authors of the letter, was developed in the context primarily prior to the formation of United for Peace and Justice, and was speaking to experiences that many of us had had prior to that development. So in many ways, and many of us who wrote that letter have continued to work in United for Peace and Justice to try to build it, develop it, and put it, move it in the right direction. So in many ways, what I want to try to do is do a little bit of a report on this experiment in working with United for Peace and Justice and give people a sense of where I think it is on some of these questions around race and racism, recognizing that it's an experiment, imperfect. I mean, it's... When United for Peace and Justice was pulled together, it was primarily around Iraq. It met for the first time in Washington, I think in late November. When we met there, it was a meeting which was about 95%, maybe even higher, white, right? When it first was pulled together here in New York, it was 95% white in early January. And you can come to some of our meetings right now, and they're still largely white, okay? So... obviously there's some continuation of some policies and practices. But what I want to try to emphasize is the steps forward. And the steps forward through our collective work together, through struggle within United for Peace and Justice to try to orient it positively, and how it's been able to take some positive steps. So all the critique that's been discussed here is primarily the context for what I want to say now. I mean, I would say that United for Peace and Justice, when it first met in January and began to build for the February 15th demonstrations here and then the February 16th demonstrations in San Francisco, was in many ways victim to or played out what Joe Freeman in 1970 called the tyranny of structurelessness, right, in referring to the feminist movement, particularly at that point, the white feminist movement, where what had happened was the way that it was pulled together was largely by relying upon people's existing political relationships or informal contacts in the movement. And as a result, it drew in people that people knew well and worked together and had a relationship with each other. And in a highly segregated and, in fact, racist society, that means that in this kind of a formation, it drew upon, since many of the initiators were primarily white, middle class, and so on, that's who it pulled together initially. And I think that's part of the lesson, is that we can't rely upon email lists or just phone calls to people we know to build organizations and coalitions, because inevitably it'll reproduce whatever hierarchy exists in the society. We have to be very conscious about trying to counteract that. I think the second thing that we discovered was that when we developed the way that the things were articulated and framed, in fact, reflected who was in the room as well. So there was one of the committees, for example, the program committee that was set up was something like 8 people. I think 7 of them were white. 1 person was a person of color. And, you know, it's no accident that the emphasis at the moment was, we can just focus on Iraq. Don't talk about anything else. Don't talk about Palestine. The stuff at home is a problem, but that's not really what we should be focusing on. And it partly was out of the conception that the people we were trying to reach were middle-class white people. That was the embedded assumption behind it, right? And so you don't want to put out stuff that could alienate people, as Merle said earlier. And so we had to challenge that. There was a question of whether or not to go forward and march. People remember that discussion, right? After they prohibited us from actually marching, right? And initially what had happened was many of the people who had been involved and who happened to be at the table at a lunchtime meeting were the folks who initially were given the decision, the decision was initially discussed there about whether or not to move forward on that. And it was a limited number of people, important, good activists. But it was a question that would profoundly affect all kinds of people who were coming out. And it was very important that we open up that discussion beyond that narrow circle to a much broader section of the movement. And that's what we pushed for and did, and I think came out with a much better discussion, where we took into account, for example, the concern of immigrant rights activists that if we marched in violation of the permit, that that could be an issue. In fact, could discourage a lot of immigrants from coming out. Those were some of the things that came up in the first period, and there was a lot of tension and struggle at times. One of the ways that we were able to deal with that or consciously try to address some of these weaknesses was there was a people of color mobilization that folks involved in Racial Justice 9/11 locally with Thurwell Within helped to pull together to develop a people of color contingent on that day. And part of what was negotiated was there was a relationship basically established where we basically said, we want to work, we're interested in working together, we think it's very important to have mass turnout this day, but we think there's some ways that there are important things that we want to negotiate to be able to do that effectively. And so we came to an agreement where we would have 75% people of color on the program and 50% women, and also where Palestine would be raised. We were a little unclear as to where what exactly the agreement was on that. It was a little fuzzy. But that was an agreement that we came to. And I think that was a very important step forward towards building what became a unique event on February 15th. Never before, in my opinion, had there been a mass peace demonstration with 500,000 people in the streets where we had, you know, hip-hop artists and Arab debka dancers and, you know, Latino salsa artists and people from Colombia and, you know, Iraq connected to a range of different issues around U.S. empire and the war at home. And I think it was a positive step forward. Again, though, while it steps forward, it wasn't perfect. We, and part of what happened was, in the rush to build for February 15th, we didn't address a lot of other issues. And in fact, not to go into a long story, but the relations that had begun to be developed or were starting to be repaired, which is a more accurate description, we didn't accomplish that by the end of it. And at the end, still, there was need to continue to develop those relationships. To jump ahead, I think that what happened was that a lot of us, for some period, felt that this to even get to that point required a lot of work and a lot of struggle, and it was de-energizing, right? People remember it. So some of us actually pulled back initially, but came to the assessment that even though it had been a struggle, it was very important to build United for Peace and Justice, that it had huge potential, and we wanted to continue to work with it and find ways to try to strengthen it, shape it, and develop it, make it useful for all of us. And that's what many of us did, I think, and we've had some more positive results recently. So I just want to talk about a couple of things that were developed at this national conference that we did in Chicago just a few weeks ago. About 550 representatives from 325 organizations around the country participated. And it was a pretty remarkable conference in many ways. It was a strategy planning conference. And to try to come together both around points of unity, around a structure, around action plans. And it was, I think, in many ways a major step forward for both United for Peace and Justice and for the anti-war, anti-racist movement in the United States. It's one of its major weaknesses right off the bat was that planning for it got started very late. Time, I think, is a major factor here to consider in how we work. Got started very late, and people were very involved in many other activities around United for Peace and Justice. And as a result, while we got, I think, a very good program and that it was very developed in many ways, one of the areas that suffered was, once again, we didn't have resources devoted to working with and developing relationships with and recruiting people of color. So the result was that the composition of the group was probably about 10 to 15% people of color, which is actually far better than I expected, you know, having done some of the last-minute work on recruitment. But obviously, that doesn't reflect our movement. That certainly doesn't reflect our society. It's a weakness. Having said that, I think we made positive steps forward. People of color were central to the leadership of it, to the planning of it, to the whole cultural dimension of it, to raising some of the central political questions. So, for instance, politically, it became very clear from early on that many of us in the room felt that it was important to link the war abroad to the war at home. And some of the politics that was articulated here, I would say, increasingly has become the politics of United for Peace and Justice and has won support for many of the participants in UFPJ. One of the outcomes was there was an agreement to work on, one of the major campaigns we're going to work on is to support the Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride that the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union in particular is organizing in October of this year. I think that's a major step forward for the peace movement to be working and supporting that kind of an effort. And to see challenging the racism against immigrants as central as it increasingly is. We elected a new leadership We actually put forward recommendations that got accepted, which were for the committee, the steering committee, to be 50% people of color, 50% women, 20% youth, 15% queer. And we actually achieved almost all of those goals in the vote. It was actually quite surprising. There were people just who were so celebrating that, you know, when we got 51% women, 51% people of color, people were actually really excited by that. Because we had no question. You remember, Steve. I mean, we felt good about it. We had made some steps forward in a way that wasn't clear we were necessarily going to do. We took a decent position on Palestine, I think. That, again, I think was a major breakthrough for United for Peace and Justice after a lot of struggle. There was resistance on February to deal with it. Over a period of months in education and struggle with each other, we moved forward. So I think the other part I want to say is that you can see also in the unity statement that we developed a unity statement that had pretty broad support in the room that, again, deals with both the war abroad and the war at home, these other manifestations of the imperial drive that's not just about Iraq, it's contextualized in this drive for empire, as well as recognition that there are power dynamics in the movement that have to be consciously addressed as much as possible. That was a statement that we agreed to at the conference. We actually had to. One of the problems was we were left with very little time, so we didn't have we weren't able to take amendments to it. We weren't able to fully test unity on all the positions in this. But basically, what happened was, given a limited amount of time, people voted to say, "Look, we're going to take this as a working statement. We're going to move ahead. We're here to do work together, and we feel like we're at that point." So I think these are positive steps forward at this level in terms of the complex task of building multiracial movements. There's much else, there are a lot of us to work to talk about, organizing specific communities of color, working in a network like Racial Justice 9/11. But here, what I really wanted to talk about was some of the challenges in building these multiracial formations and how we can take or have been able to take some positive steps forward. Again, it's been a big process of struggle at times, but we're moving forward. And I hope that people will... it's not primarily about selling UFPJ by any means, but to say that working together and having with a core people, with a group that works together with a certain amount of anti-racist politics can play an important role at a particular moment in a coalition. Thank you.
Thank you, Henny. Can we have just one last round of applause for all the panelists? So I know it's getting hot in here, y'all, as frequently happens at the Breck Forum in the middle of the summer. But we do want to move into some heated and excited discussion around these issues. But before I do that, I just want to make a few quick announcements. For those of you who are here for the first time, this is the Breck Forum, New York Marxist School. Liz Roberts and Liz Mestres in the back are staff members of the organization and can provide you with other materials. And more information about the Breck Forum. The Breck Forum has been here in New York for the last 21 years. 27, my bad. And there are programs in the back for the summer program of the Breck Forum, which there are always workshops, panels, consortiums, and different activities going on here to help further the social and economic and political justice movement in New York, nationally and globally. So with that, I also just want to, I'm supposed to make a plug for the annual intensive Introduction to Marxist Theory, which is happening from July 10th through the 13th, and that's going to be here at the Breck Forum, and that's a session addressing war, empire, and capital. If you want more information on that, I believe that there are flyers in the back. The other thing that I wanted to make an announcement about is a panel discussion on the quote-unquote roadmap, which is happening at the Kevorkian Basement Center at NYU, 50 Washington Square South. And the panel discussion will be with Rebaba Abdulhadi, Orly Lubin, Miro Gal, and others. And so if you want information about that event,
when is that
tomorrow at 7 p.m. If folks want more information about how to get there and whatever, you can come see me. I have the information here. We can photocopy maybe, or we can just write down.